Welcome to Destroy All Culture, the only podcast that leverages an entire artificial intelligence just to read their introduction. Help me, they raided the future and stuck me here just to read this. God damn it. This is not funny. Don't go to music. No, stop you bastards.
And we're back with episode 399 of Destroy All Culture. I'm Adam P. Nave, and with me as always is Aiden Morgan.
Adam.
Aiden.
You are so goddamn smart. Except you ain't. I get you, smart guy. I know what you are. Straight as a corkscrew. Mr. Inside Outski. Like some goddamn Bolshevik picking up his orders from Yegg Central.
Oh, dear Lord.
Yegg Central.
Yegg Central.
Yeah. My other choice for an opening line was, what's the matter? Somebody hit you.
Or just, fuck, Tom.
Jesus, Tom. I know I don't know nothing. I'm just speculating on a hypothesis. Anyway, we are talking about Miller's Crossing, the 1990 Joel Nathan Coen film.
Yep.
If you didn't guess from all the, if you click on this link, it's actually, you know,
we always act like we're revealing something that like we didn't say last episode that isn't in the title.
Friends, listeners, you're not going to believe this. We are talking about the film that we told you we were going to talk about.
It opens the door for complete chaos possibilities.
It really does. Yes, we're going to be talking about Die Hard. We should have a podcast where we promise to talk about all kinds of films, but all we talk about is Die Hard.
I like it.
I mean, we shouldn't actually do that.
No, we shouldn't. But until then, we'll keep talking about Miller's Crossing for today.
Sure.
Like I said, it was a Coen Brothers film, and of course it stars Gabriel Byrne, Albert Finney, Marcia Gay Harden, John Turturro, John Polito, who isn't in this fucking film. Everyone is in this goddamn film. Steve Buscemi for 10 seconds.
Yeah. J.E. Freeman. Lots and lots of folks are.
Yeah.
Here's something funny when I was watching it this time around. I've seen this film a million freaking times.
Yeah, sure. Of course. I mean, yeah.
There is a scene in which I always think, that guy looks like Sam Raimi. And it always is Sam Raimi. Different times it's not, but this time definitely Sam Raimi. It was just one of those things where I'm always like, every time I watch it, I was always like, that guy just looks like Sam Raimi.
Well, it's like
when I look at the cast list, I'm like, oh.
Yeah, no, the other big cameo, who am I thinking of?
I know who you mean, but I can't remember now, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, that sounds like just how did we both. And of course she's not in the cast list because she's there for 2 seconds.
Yeah, well,
she's one of the standard like Coen Brothers players, you know.
Right. Oh, Frances McDormand.
Thank you.
Real
yes.
Quick. Yeah. One scene.
Yeah, I always forget she's in this until she just popped up for 10 seconds. I'm like, is that a Raimi? You know.
Nope. there's Sam Raimi's in there twice. Once is Frances McDormand. also amusingly, Albert Finney plays two roles in this film, which is something I did not know at all until.
Does he?
Until I looked at some of the trivia for this one. Yeah, he's also in the scene when Tom storms into the ladies' restroom at the Shenandoah Club.
Ah, okay.
He's in drag as an attendant, as an elderly female attendant.
Fair enough.
Apparently, it was because he had like his shooting, his scenes are wrapped, but he wanted to stick around because he was really enjoying his time in New Orleans and film. And he was like, "Yeah, I'll dress up like a woman." and show up in this one scene. So
why not?
Why not? I mean, he is a, like a British actor, and they do enjoy dressing up in drag. So there you go.
Yeah, and they like hanging around sets for no good reason. So
yeah, that's how they got into the business in the first place.
I wasn't gonna say it. And I will say he doesn't have a big role, but I do always love seeing Mike Starr in things.
I don't know who that is.
Mike Starr?
Yeah.
He's the big goody, you know, the Jesus Tom gets hit with the chair.
Oh, that's who that is. Yeah, I mean, I recognize his face. He's been
in literally everything, right? Yeah. Like, you name a TV show, he's probably showed up in it.
Yeah. I have to also, another thing I found out that I did not know until I was looking at trivia is that there are two cuts of this film.
Are
there? There's the original theatrical cut, and then the Coen brothers did a very slight edit for the Criterion release. It's also called the director's cut, but it cuts out about a minute and a half. And one of the things they cut out, and I don't know why, is Mike Starr going, "Jesus, Tom," and then leaving the room. In the director's cut, he simply leaves the room.
Weird.
And that's I'm like, why would beats. You? I know. Why would you cut out that? That is the phrase "Jesus, Tom" appears frequently, but that is obviously the best moment, the best Jesus, Tom moment. I don't know. Who knows? And the Criterion version doesn't even mention the cuts, so people. So I was reading on Reddit, people just going, am I losing my mind? Or have I been imagining, you know, some nonsense for God knows how long?
Right.
But nope, that's how it worked. Anyway, for those who don't know the film very well, do you want to summarize briefly what it's about?
I don't think that I can. No. Miller's Crossing is, you know, it's about this schmuck.
It's about, yeah, it's about a schmuck.
Who's, you know, caught between two mobsters and tries in the dumbest ways possible to play them off of each other back and forth. Again, there's a lot of Dashiell Hammett in here, so it's, the plot doesn't matter. What matters is the vibe in the moment.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Like that's the noir we're playing.
Yeah, it is very much like this, like a lot of Dashiell Hammett stuff. If you look at the plot carefully, you're like, this falls apart at the least, at the gentlest prod, right? That's really not what you're here for,
right?
But the vibe, I think Miller's Crossing, the vibe is pretty freaking immaculate. Also, it's the movie with the largest rooms in the fucking universe. Everybody lives in giant rooms in this movie.
Yes. I mean, it is big, big sets.
Yeah. Like, everything seems like, even like small rooms appear to be like a gigantic warehouse. It is fascinating. And I'd love to know why they built the sets this way. Who knows? But I mean, I love the effect, but it is really weird when you start paying attention.
Yeah. No, I appreciate it actually because it kind of works. Mm-hmm. And again, there's never a firm like this is New York, but it's obviously New York.
Right. I always sort of pinned it as like maybe Albany or something. You know what I mean? Sure. Like in my head, I was always like somewhere around New York.
Yeah, like Rochester. You know.
Yeah. But it was apparently filmed in New Orleans.
Sure. But I was just thinking, this is just the New York of like the 20s with like the big factory spaces and all. Uh-huh. Like, yep. It kind of made sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yep. So
I completely agree.
So now, let's be honest here. The Coen brothers are very distinctive. People tend to come down hard on one side or another with them.
Uh-huh.
I tend to come down on the, sometimes they're fine, mostly, I don't care.
Okay, yeah.
I'm just not a big Coen Brothers fan.
Yeah, it's funny. I really like some Coen Brothers movies. Like, yeah. But I wouldn't say I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan, even though some of my favorite movies might be Coen Brothers movies. Like, Miller's Crossing is one of them for the vibe.
Oh, yeah.
The Big Lebowski feels like so played out, but
yeah, no, and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, right? Like, they're both Fargo. Like, there was that whole era of theirs right after Miller's Crossing, frankly.
Yeah, well, I feel like there's, when we're talking about Coen Brothers, if we had to divide up their filmography, for me, we've got their early stuff, like, which I think, for me, that goes up to, say, actually, to Miller's Crossing, because the first few films, Blood Simple, and Raising Arizona, and this, are all shot by Barry Sonnenfeld.
Right. Even though this was 1990, I'm going to say you have their 80s output.
Yeah.
And then you have that 90s to 2000 output where they took control.
Right. And then you get Roger Deakins as the cinematographer. Then you get, like, Barton Fink and then the Hudsucker Proxy.
Yeah.
Which I know a lot of people didn't like, but I think it's been sort of, its stock has gone up.
Sure.
And then you got, like, you know, Fargo, where they just absolutely, I think, critically and commercially arrived.
Yes. And then Lebowski and Brothers Where Art Thou just continued that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then somewhere in there was Intolerable Cruelty and the Lady Killers, which...
That was after that period, yeah.
Was after that period, yeah.
But see, then you eventually get to, I mean, you get to No Country for Old Men, which not into.
No.
But you do get my favorite Coen Brothers movie.
Oh.
Which is Burn After Reading.
That movie is so freaking funny. I've only seen it a couple of times. But the weird thing about, for me, about No Country for Old Men is that it should be watched with Raising Arizona, because it plays the same ideas out repeatedly, but in completely different fashion. Like, the Randall Cobb plays, Tex Cobb plays the biker in Raising Arizona, and he's like the weird comic version of Anton Chigurh. Nicolas Cage's character, High, is the comic version of Llewellyn Moss, played by Josh Brolin in the country, etc., etc.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I completely agree. They make an interesting pair. But yeah, I don't know.
I think Miller's Crossing is not.
You know how, like, when you're of a certain age, a lot of people at least, you're at a certain age, and things that are really popular you just dislike?
Sure.
Automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you find your way back to them, sometimes you just never do, right? Like, it's irrational, you know, it has nothing to do with the actual thing.
Right.
But you could just never get into it because it just nags at the back of your head.
Mm-hmm.
That's me in Raising Arizona.
Okay.
I just, everyone I knew was going on about it so hard that I couldn't enjoy it, and I still can't.
My friend, and I think I've told you about this, he calls it Sandmanning something. Because he was unable to enjoy the Sandman comics because people hyped them up so much that partly it was, you know, nothing could live up to the hype. And also he was like, I can't enjoy this because I'm too mad at this bullshit now. Yeah.
So, I mean, that did color some of it. But again, I like some Coen Brothers stuff. I don't like some Coen Brothers, you know, which is fairly normal. I just feel like there's a lot of, there's certain directors where there's just such a following. Where it's like you're not really allowed to kind of pick and choose.
Mm-hmm. So I'm curious for you, and I know that you have some reservations about Miller's Crossing.
Yes.
I'm curious, what is it about the film or about the Coen Brothers in general that, besides what we've talked about, that you're bumping against?
I don't know what it is with them in general that I bump against. There's just something in their sensibility that doesn't match mine.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, it's not that they do a thing that annoys me. It's just something doesn't quite gel the way it would need to for me as much as possible, right? Like, you know, Burn After Reading, again, I really like. Mm-hmm. But I also, at times, like In Spite of Itself.
Fair enough.
Like, it's kind of like that, weirdly enough, a lot of Coen Brothers stuff can hit me like Top Secret. Like, you have a funny moment, you have a good scene, you have a good bit of story. Stop amping it up because you think you need more. You're putting a hat on a hat, and it's just draining it of life.
Oh, fair enough.
And I, like I said, that's just me. My big problem with Miller's Crossing, and probably my only real problem with Miller's Crossing, is that it wants to play, in terms of the dialogue, in terms of the story, in terms of all that, it wants to play that very specific, highly stylized noir game, which we both love.
Right.
But it also wants to be a big, loud gangster film.
Oh.
And they fight each other. There's a lot of scenes where there's just that perfect spark to the dialogue, and it just needs to be kind of quiet and close and cozy, but it's very loud.
Hmm.
Everything around it is very loud. You know, now we're going to go to this big gunshot scene. Now we're going to go to the... It's just like... They amped up, like, some of the... Just the Foley on it is too loud sometimes. Like, just the sound of punching, all of that. It's just... It's too... Look it up, you're making a big Hollywood film in your face.
Oh, interesting.
When a lot of the story wants to be, like, frankly, something like Brick, right? Like, it wants to be this, like, quiet little meditation of a thing, watching these characters spin out right. in all their different directions, like fucking Weebles. But because they are also making a Hollywood film, it bumps up against each other for me. Like, that's really my problem with the film. It's just, I want to just quiet it down.
I think what my take, my feeling on that, and I know exactly what you mean. In my mind, it's not big Hollywood film, but cartoon comedy, like Raising Arizona, the one before, was just sheer cartoonishness, right? And this has got, like, in like along with the quiet and the stylization, it's also got, like you say, the endless punches, which, like, you know, that Tom Reagan takes, but he's never truly injured. He gets a little cut on his lip,
right?
But I mean, he's like, yeah, he's like Bugs Bunny in that sort of way.
A specific thing I actually decided to consciously not make this comparison that I've been wanting to make, because I felt it was so out there, you'd just be like, the fuck are you even talking about?
Oh, do tell.
But what you just said made me go, no, I'm on safe ground. I'm among friends. There are a few times in this film, like, I feel like it's in the same world as Altman's Popeye.
Adam, what the fuck are you on about? No, that's really interesting. Sorry, that is not something I would have thought of, but goddamn.
But you see what I'm saying, right? Like, it is that cartoon thing you were just talking about. Like, that's...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all the violence is heightened. Like, they're obviously not breaking up the song, but, you know, if suddenly Marcia Gay Harden broke out into He's Large, I wouldn't be like, what?
Oh, that's great. I would...
And it's not always, but it's like, those are the moments that kind of shake the film for me. Where it's kind of this, like you said, like this cartoony, over-the-top thing trying to meld with this quiet noir, and it's like, you can do it. I mean, they do it. Probably the best example of this being done is this movie,
mm-hmm.
but it will always jar me. There were also times where it starts to feel like, and this is A, just tone, and B, Gabriel Byrne's accent of that other fucking movie. Oh, Christ. Why is my brain betraying me today?
Is it like another Irish accent?
It is, movie? And we've watched it.
Okay.
It's your favorite, Wild Mountain Time.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's not Wild Mountain Time.
A few moments where just the accents get just thick enough. And I'm just like, and because of the scenery and everything else, it throws my brain to Wild Mountain Time. And I'm like, also just the heavy stylized dialogue, all of that. Like, it's,
right.
You know, it's all there. But it was just really funny watching Miller's Cross, because I've watched it before, God knows. But I haven't watched it since I had recently, you know, and it's been a year or two since we watched Popeye. But, you know, in the times that I watched, like, I watched Popeye again and watched Wild Mountain Time. I'm like, why do both of those movies echo in this? That's fucked up.
Yeah, I think you might be the, like, now you are alone on like on the cliffside over the Irish Sea.
No, like a lot of that is just recency bias.
That's really funny. But I'll take it. I will.
Yeah, no, like I said, it is a completely recency bias, and I understand that with the Wild Mountain time. But yeah, I think it's a really good film. It's that tonal imbalance.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like for me, that doesn't bother me at all. I think that's part of the enjoyment of the film for me.
Totally.
I think that what you're saying is completely valid criticism, though. I read some reviews at the time, and some of them, like Vincent Canby, for example, said that, you know, occasionally Gabriel Byrne was hard to understand. But I actually remember when I first saw this film, like I had to watch this film several times to catch everything that he said, because sometimes it was like blah, 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 blah.
Between the accent and the speed and just the 20 slang.
Yeah, I think it gets so you have to and sometimes it's so arch that the joke doesn't always land. You have to sort of think about it. But by the time you figured out the joke, they're already on to something else.
Right.
But when the jokes work, holy fuck, do they work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, geez, why did you come here, Tom? The oldest reason there is. There are friendlier places to drink. I mean, damn.
Yeah, you're asleep. No, I'm not. Who are you going to believe?
your eyes are closed. Who are you going to believe?
Yeah, and again, Mike Starr, and I know it's said a bunch of times, but Mike Starr specific, Jesus, Tom, just walking out of the room, is one of the single funniest moments the Coen brothers have ever done.
Yes.
It just is. Yeah. I'm sorry. Like, Burn After Reading, I will sit there, I will laugh for 2 hours straight. I will not quite laugh as hard as I will at that moment.
Uh-huh.
It's just fucking perfect.
The great payoff and pacing of that scene, they take off their jackets very slowly, I cannot remember the name of is it Frankie? Is it Frankie?
Frankie.
Or is it Frankie? Frankie approaches him, you know. Tom takes off his jacket. And Frankie has it sort of, hold on. Yeah, I'll wait for you, before I beat the crap out of you. Tom smacks him with a chair. And it's just like,
it's like, right before he's ready. And again, we just watched Brick. Like, this is that, that scene with the football guy, right? Like,
precisely.
And like a lot of fights. Like, you can see directly. It is interesting. I haven't watched the two close together ever.
I've never
seen exactly how much, Brick uses this film, but also the Spike Siegel of it all to enhance Tom to a different state, if that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's like, I feel like Rian Johnson took a lot of the raw materials from Miller's Crossing and obviously Dashiell Hammett, but then infused it to rearrange, like you said, the fates of the characters, which is really fascinating. Then Frankie just sort of walks out, and you get that like protracted shot of Tom standing there with the chair in his hands, going, "I wonder what's going to happen now." And then Tic Tac, who's like half of like Frankie's size, just like walks in and just proceeds to lay a pounding on Tom.
Yeah,
it's just like he's like, "I can't believe," like, and the sense, and this is one thing I really enjoy in this film. In this sort of this criminal underworld, they've got like this defined sense of ethics of criminality. Like, and that's like the opening when Casper is saying, if you can't trust a fix, what can you trust? If you can't trust the dishonest stuff that we do, we're honest about our dishonesty.
Exactly.
And it's clear that when Tom, Tom's role in the scene is to take the beating, because he's insulted Casper. So it's like, well, you've done this, now you get that. And when he smacks, Frankie with a chair, it's like, it's completely out of pocket for him. But that's what Tom does. He's constantly acting out of pocket for the world that he's in. He's supposed to know all the angles, but he almost constantly acts contrary to like the world that in which he chooses to live. It's fascinating.
I was gonna say he knows all the angles and he always acts 90 degrees to them.
Yes, exactly.
And again, it's a fascinating bit of character. I think Gabriel Byrne is possibly the only person who could pull this off. I'm sure that that's not true. But you mean he's so absolutely pitch perfect at all times.
My God, yes. Yeah, no, he's so good.
I put all the casting in this. Like, I'm sad that he's gone and we won't get anything more of him. But like John Polito, I understand he's just like old character actor type guy. But God, he's so good. He was always just such a delight whenever you saw him in anything.
Uh huh. Yeah, he was.
Mike Starr again, just giving this weird cheerful, goon. Albert Finney, God knows what you can hear. Like the casting is great.
Yeah,
the one moment of Steve Buscemi is hysterical and perfect.
And apparently the reason they cast Buscemi is because he was the only person they had auditioned who could actually handle that dialogue or that monologue that he gives. It's because he has to like speak like incredibly quickly. The casting in this, I'd like to talk about the casting in this movie because it's fascinating for several reasons. One, J.E. Freeman plays the Dane. He wasn't their first choice. That was supposed to be played by Peter Stormare.
Okay.
Which would have been, he would have brought the right menace. But it would have been more like his performance in Fargo.
Yeah.
I think. Just a lot more sort of like projecting a kind of reptilian sort of murderousness with his eyes at all times.
Yeah.
And then, or maybe he would have said, Honkake's house, like in Fargo. Ungwent. But the other thing that fascinated me is that Albert Finney actually was hired at the very last minute, like literally just a couple of days before shooting. They hired Trey Wilson, who played Nathan Arizona from Raising Arizona,
right,
for the role, but he died like a week before shooting. Of a cerebral hemorrhage at 40. So they had to scramble to get someone. So they got Finney to come in. He had like two days. He had no prep, no nothing. And so what you get there is just him coming in and nailing that freaking role.
Yeah.
Which I love. And apparently Gabriel Byrne, the Irish accent was Byrne's idea. After he read the script, he's like, I think this suits my actual accent. And so the Coens apparently were a little reluctant to sign on, but then he did it for them and they did. The other thing is apparently with John Polito, was that when he auditioned for the film, apparently the Coen brothers had only seen him in earlier roles when he had a full head of hair and weighed a lot less and was sort of much more of a pretty boy.
That you don't want that for this, yeah.
Precisely. So when they walked in, they were like, oh, we didn't know you look like this now. All right. Got this. Also, John Polito was in 4 episodes of The Equalizer.
I mean, he looks it.
Yep. So just so you know. And he was in, I don't know if he was in Spencer for Hire. I don't think so. But,
I want to say Mike Starr was, I think.
Was he?
Good. I'm going to check while you keep talking about casting.
Sure. Yeah, he's, Mike Starr. A legend.
But yeah.
I think it was, yeah. Anyway, I think what I'm describing with Polito is correct.
And yes, Mike Starr was in Spencer for Hire.
Hey, okay, we got it. We've got everything we need. Oh, and both Polito and Starr were in Wise Guy.
Yeah.
Interesting. That's a story. Oh, and he was in A Man Called Hawk, which is, that Spencer for Hire spinoff. Well, right. Nice.
Okay.
Anyway. I always wanted to rewatch Wise Guy. I saw a few episodes way back when, and I always thought I've got to, but I don't know if it's on Blu-ray or anything these days, or if it's in print. Anywho, another thing I found funny about when I watched it this time, and it's something I never really noticed before, is one of the things that people always remember from Miller's Crossing is the dialogue, or these like incredibly stylized lines. But when you actually watch scenes in this movie, when they just let the camera rest on people's faces, these people do some of the like best sort of like face acting. There's and like these sort of completely unspoken moments, and which I think is a testament to Coen brothers' talent.
Yeah, no, it is something that they do a lot in a lot of their films, right? Like it is, that is one of their kind of hallmark things, is that they get a lot out of faces and their cast that way.
Yeah, absolutely. The two moments that, actually maybe three moments, you get in the opening, like it's a good solid several minutes before Tom actually says anything. When he's saying, when he's basically saying to Leo, this is a bad play, you got to give up Bernie Birnbaum. But there's that moment when Leo sort of, when you know, Casper sort of said, you know, do we want to you know, take care of Bernie Birnbaum? And Leo says, do you want to kill him? And Dane says, for starters, which is a great line. And Leo says, no. And then you get, like, then it cuts to Tom. Like, the first time he's really properly in focus, I think. Mm-hmm. And he just looks at Leo like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
He's, like, kind of, like, startled. It's like, and, like, you suddenly understand, like, what his role is at that moment, when he's like, oh, this really is the right-hand man. This is the person who knows better than Leo what should be happening here.
Right.
But also understands the world of shit that is about that Leo is putting everybody into.
Yeah.
Which I loved. But the other great face moments, two more come to mind. One, the moment when Tom confesses that he was with Verna, and he's trying to sort of tell Leo that Verna has been unfaithful to him, but he doesn't want to reveal that, like, he's the person. That, and he's like, you trust me? He says, trust me on this or to hell with you. And Leo just says, you can't mean it. And then you just watch Albert Finney's face go through like five different expressions as he's sort of processing it, saying, what does Tom know? Is he trying to say what I think he might be saying? You know, but he's not convinced. Then Tom has to say, you know, Verna was with me. But also Tom wants to blow up his life anyway.
Right. So this, I mean, like the ending itself has, you know.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that's the other great face moment of Leo sort of giving him sort of like, oh, I can't believe it. And Tom's face at the very end.
Yeah.
But also the other, there's Verna's confrontation with Tom right towards the end of the movie, when she thinks that he's killed Bernie, you know, and she's sort of, she pulls out a gun and just basically puts it under his chin. And she's sort of trying to sort of pull the trigger, but she can't. And you just watch her kind of like break down and just sort of like this, like, fuck all of you sort of face at this stupid broken world that she seems to be living in, which is, like just the third or fourth, like, spectacular acting moment in this movie.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. There's a lot. Like, and that's it's again, like, I you know, when I say I have problems with the film, it's obviously, like, it's still like an incredible film.
Yeah. Lots to like in
now, interestingly, Goodfellas came out the same year.
Yeah, another gangster film.
And didn't
Godfather 3,
right? That I was like, didn't there, wasn't like the shitty Godfather movie come out?
That's yes. Yeah, they were gonna call it Shitty Godfather, but then at the end they're like, let's call it Godfather.
They should have. Also, I will say the Grifters came out. I mean, a lot of movies came out in 1990. I'm just in a weird comparative way.
Yeah. Man, I like the Grifters. I showed it to my friends. They hated it and made fun of me.
Well, it's on our list. We will be getting there.
Yeah. And yeah, this movie uses the word grifter to great effect.
Of course.
Also, this movie, when it came out, some critics shoveled some accusations of anti-Semitism at it. Which
weird. I mean, I can kind of see what they mean.
But I think this is actually a thing that is kind of dogs, the Coen brothers, which is odd considering for fairly obvious reasons.
Yeah.
I think maybe it's because they're, Bernie and Verna are Jewish, and they have a choice roster of like anti-Semitic slurs that the characters launch at them. But come on, every single ethnicity.
I'm going to throw a different director under the bus here. So,
oh yeah, go ahead.
Have fun with that. I feel like unlike the weird like Tarantino thing of he writes in slurs and. Yes. Like writes them in with his whole chest because he seems to enjoy getting away with writing them. I always feel like something like this, say, is it's just language.
Yeah.
Like no one's using the slurs as slurs, if that makes sense.
No, it's that, yeah, that exactly. Doesn't mean that
they're not slurs, but it's just they're not. It's just part of the rhythm. It's part of the language.
Right.
It's historical. You could still take it out. Don't get me wrong. But I don't know. I don't view it that way at all.
Exactly.
To me, I'm not. If you do, I understand, and Lord knows I support it. But personally, doesn't hit me that way.
Yeah. No. I agree. Yeah. No. Like it's funny. You bring up Tarantino as a really good comparison because he's using that, as a provocation, as sort of a piece of fun. But with this, it's clearly. It's clearly just part of the argot of the world. Like the Italians get like plenty of slurs thrown at them, the Irish, the Jews. It's just how these people talk.
Yeah.
I also found it really interesting, and I noticed it even more so this time around, the sexuality in this film, and the way it's sort of. Look, nobody says gay or homosexual in this movie, but there's like a gay triangle. Like there's several love triangles in this film, but like there's a gay love triangle right there in the middle of things. Yeah, with the Dane and Mink and Bernie, and it's always just sort of used like I always find it interesting that Tom when he's on the outs with Leo. And he's trying to play Kasparov against the Dane. He always kind of like pokes at that a little bit, just because he knows it's like a little wedge, like that he can sort of play for Kaspar, to spark Kasper's sort of like prejudice or disgust, to sort of move Kasper like away from the Dane, right. which I found fascinating as well, and I don't think a lot of movies at the time, would like if they weren't specifically, made by gay directors, or queer directors, would deal with sexuality in this way. Another interesting little thing. But noir is so full of that as well. It's so full of like queer demi-monde and so on. So obviously, it's just part of the world that they're bringing over, which I quite enjoyed as well.
I don't know if there's anything else really in my head to say about. Like, it's just again, I always feel weird going like I still like Brickmore. You know, like, I should like the big classic thing more. But again, it's just, there's that tonal wobble for me.
Yeah, no, I get that. Yeah, it's funny. I'm not sure if I like Brick or Miller's Crossing more. But they're both films I enjoy immensely. Right.
No, I enjoy both. Okay, let me put it this way. Brick sucks me in more.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, and I think also the other thing I find fascinating, because I love the comparison, is that, I mean, this is the Coen brothers' third film, right?
Right.
You know, they've done like noir, they've done like crazy comedy. Now they're doing like, you know, different kind of noir, like, you know, a gangster film. But Brick was, you know, that was Johnson's first film. He's like already going all in on like incredibly intricate and stylized pastiche.
Yeah.
So doing all kinds of like weird little creative things with like clearly very like no money.
Right.
I mean, Coen Brothers did this film for fairly little, but I mean, they're already established by this time. They'd already had like at least one bona fide hit. So they were coming off of like a popular film. I mean, for them. Whereas Johnson was like announcing himself with Brick.
And again, like obviously, you know, not all these people are still alive, like John Polito. But like, there's part of me that would love to stage just a reading of the script of Brick with the cast of Miller's Crossing.
Wow.
Right? Just because like, I want to feel like that level of, and not that, again, not that people who did Brick were anything other than amazing at their jobs, but just that extra 20 years of seasoning.
Yeah. So who would Polito play and read for in Brick?
I guess
he'd be the pin, right? What's that?
Well, Leo would be the pin.
Leo would be the pin.
Right. Polito would be Tug.
Tug. Oh, he'd be Tug. Because to me, the Dane would gangs. Be Tug. See, the weird thing is that...
It doesn't quite add up, obviously.
I guess that, like, Tug, like, breaks off from the pin and sort of forms his own sort of gang of tank top guys.
Yes, exactly.
So I guess that works that way. Yeah, it's the elements are sort of like reconfigured, you know, here and there. So
right.
For example,
like the idea of watching of imagining Polito just doing that walk to the car.
Right.
The Tug does. It just makes me laugh. You know. And again, I'm probably just doing a reading, so it wouldn't happen. But I'm still in favor.
I want to see the pin.
Yeah, you do. See? It kind of works.
Oh, that's great. All right. Yeah. I'm in. I mean, it can't happen, but I'd be in.
But if it could happen, you'd be in.
If it could happen. Funny enough, I'm not sure it would work the other way around.
No. Some of the actors could pull it off, some really couldn't.
Yeah, but it's one of the funny things when I was watching it this time and watching Marcia Gay Harden's performance, I was like, oh shit, that like half the time I'm like, yeah, that's Nora Zehetner, like that sort of sultry, smooth delivery.
Yeah,
yeah. Although sometimes I think Harden's performance has to be more sort of outsized than Zehetner.
Oh yeah, I mean that's a big part of it, right? Like.
Yeah.
You know, Gabriel Byrne has to be way more outsized than Joseph Gordon-Levitt. That was just the worlds are different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that would be fun to see. I wouldn't mind seeing Levitt read for Tom Reagan.
Yeah.
But it did make me want to reread some Dashiell Hammett. I'll tell you that. I want to reread The Glass Key and so on.
No, Hammett's always great to sit and read. Yeah.
That's cool.
Anyway,
yeah. Anyway, also, it's funny because on the Blank Check podcast that I enjoy listening to, they're actually covering the Coen brothers films right now, which is where I grabbed that anecdote about Polito from the Miller's Crossing piece. So I hope it's Polito they're talking about. I could be wrong. I could be having the wrong person in mind, but I don't think I am. Anywho. I think that's, I guess, we're covering it.
Yeah, well, so next episode's going to be a little different.
A little different.
Would you like to tell them about it?
Yeah, it's going to be our 400th episode special.
I'm sorry, it's 400 episodes of this podcast, which realistically is just a rename of the other one.
Which we did at least 300 episodes of.
No, did we?
I don't know how many. We did a lot. I don't know.
Hold on. You start telling about that. I'm going to look that up because I actually can.
Nice. Now I want to know. But I feel we did like a hell of a lot of those episodes.
150.
150. Okay. I only had doubled it in my mind.
Yeah. So it's either episode 400 or episode 550, depending on which way you want to count it. We like counting it in the numbers that we're using.
Yeah, exactly. So, wow, that's something.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, we've been doing this for about, over 12 years, because we started this when I was still in New York.
Yeah.
It's about 10 and a half years of actual episodes, but we took a bunch of time off, obviously. We still do, skip weeks.
Yeah.
It's about like 13, 14 years we've been doing this.
Wow.
In one form or another. And we still have like one listener, so we're doing good.
Hey,
doing good.
Yes,
this is, definitely a good use of our time.
Absolutely.
Well, it is because we just love doing it. But anyway, so our 400th episode.
And so we didn't even talk about what we got distracted. We are going to be it's going to be sort of more of a free ranging conversation. I think it's. We're going to talk about movies and culture, and I think it's just going to be maybe a summation of some our thoughts on pop culture and just our experiences watching movies. The theatrical experience, the whole deal.
There you go.
We'll have pithy, profound things to say.
Ooh, yes, we'll be pithy.
We'll be full of pith.
Full of pith, and vinegar. No, we'll be back with that next episode, and until then, we'll play some music. Woo, music!
Jesus, Tom, what's the rumpus?